So first, I just wanted to tie up a loose end from last time when I suffered an embarrassing real-time defeat at the hands of some Christoffel symbols. I went back, we had a rematch, and I won the rematch, so this is how it works. The thing that I was trying to prove is that we were trying to read off the normalization of the mode functions for the gravitational waves, which means computing the term. To get that commutator right, you just need to know the term in the Einstein-Hilbert action that contains two derivatives in the gravitational waves. I found it easier. There are some sort of high-tech tricks you can use, but I found it easiest to just go through the whole chain of steps that lead to the Einstein-Hilbert action. Working the whole Einstein-Hilbert action out to second order and the fluctuations is a big calculation, but if you just aim for the term that contains two derivatives of the gravitational waves, it's not so bad. I looked at the Christoffel symbols and just computed the Christoffel symbols with one time derivative in Hij. And I found if you just go through the combinatorics of which terms contribute, in this Christoffel symbol, there is this Hij dot. And in this Christoffel symbol, there's this Hij dot. And that's it. When you put them into, and this is the bit that was getting me confused before, when you put these into the next, compute the Ricci tensor. If you go through this expression for the Ricci tensor, now I'm keeping the terms that have two derivatives on Hij dot, Hij. Then in R0,0, I get this term. And then in Rij, I get this term, which is going to contribute because it'll get multiplied by an Hij when I compute the scalar curvature. When I compute the scalar curvature, the metric with two indices raised has an Hij in it. So I get an extra term here coming from this guy. And without that term, it looks like you get the wrong sign. Oh, this just should be not minimized. Without that term, it looks like you get the wrong sign. But with that term, the integration by parts cancels off this term. And you get the correctly normalized action. Okay. That calculation isn't really a big deal. I just had an error in my notes, so I got confused with the board. All right, so just to sort of recap last time. So a powerful tool for working out the physics of inflation in different gauges is to compare to the case of a massless test scalar in FRW. So this is a just to review those formulas. So the test scalar, each mode of the test scalar satisfies the Mukhanov-Sasaki equation of motion. I'm writing the expansion history as z here for reasons that will be useful shortly. Or you could canonically normalize. And this phi is the phi that appears in this form of the Mukhanov-Sasaki equation is the variable that is constant after horizon crossing at late times. Another form of the Mukhanov-Sasaki equation, this is the way it's usually written, is to write things in terms of the canonically normalized field, where you just define psi equals z phi and get rid of this prefactor at the expense of putting extra time dependence into the potential term. And then just an equivalent way of writing the same equation is this. This is what's usually called the Mukhanov-Sasaki equation. The reason that comparing to this case is useful is that we learned one really powerful fact here, which is that if the expansion is slow roll, and if the normalization is the same as the normalization in this action, which let me write that normalization as either psi psi prime equals I or phi z squared phi prime equals I. Then the late time power spectrum, because this variable phi is constant after horizon crossing, it makes sense to talk about its late time power spectrum. Then the late time power spectrum is just hg squared over 2k cubed, where the h is evaluated at horizon crossing. And so the way the gravity waves worked is that we found that in the cosmologist normalization, the action for each component of the gravity waves looked like this. And similarly for h times. From which we can read off, just by comparing to this case, that h plus is the quantity which is constant at late times, not, say, h plus with some power of a. And because its canonical normalization read off from the action is, so I commute h with its conjugate momentum, which is m Planck squared over 16, over 8, a squared h prime. Because the normalization that we ended up with in the action differs from the sort of reference case by a factor of m Planck squared over 8, then the power spectrum of the gravity waves at late times is just given by the standard case, but with an 8 over m Planck squared in front. It's going to be the, you know, the inverse square root of this factor that appears in the normalization. It appears in the mode functions. So this times h squared evaluated at horizon crossing times 2k cubed. In this case, the expansion history A, the real expansion history, is what appears in the equation of motion for the modes. So we end up with the power spectrum fluctuations in the gravity waves whose dimensionless size, that's k cubed over k cubed times p of k, whose dimensionless variance is h over m Planck squared, fluctuations of size h over m Planck. Nearly scale invariant, but with a small tilt, because you evaluate h at horizon crossing, and because h is decreasing during inflation, the power spectrum will slowly decrease with k. Now, let's do the inflaton. So in the spatially flat gauge, delta phi satisfies a second order equation of motion. Which we can write schematically like this. Equals a big mess involving 0 or 1 time derivatives. If you know what to aim for, if you know that you're trying to write the equation of motion for delta phi so that it looks like the Mukhanov-Sasaki equation with some expansion history z that can possibly differ from A, then after some algebra, I'll say to be shown later, because there's a better way to do this. I worked this out because I have sort of obsessive compulsive tendencies about algebra for some reason. Right? The calculation does work. This can be put in the Mukunov-Sasaki form. Let me write it. It's simplest to write it in terms of the canonically normalized field, the analog of psi here. So the second derivative of the combination A delta phi satisfies the Mukunov-Sasaki equation. A delta phi, where z is fake expansion history, which includes A, but also the derivative of the background solution of the Infleton equations of motion and the Hubble parameter H. So these factors in the slow roll approximation are slowly varying with time. They don't change much fractionally in a Hubble. So this locally looks like the real expansion history rescaled. But the rescaling does slowly run with time. So if we're asking questions that evolve over many Hubbles, so to speak, then we do need to worry about this normalization. So this is all exact, no slow roll approximation. But let me remind you that in the slow roll approximation, we're going to see this. Slow roll is sort of a systematic way of expanding any quantity like phi bar in terms of H and slow roll parameters. In this case, phi dot expands to this. So what's a little confusing is that there are two expansion histories, A and Z, and you have to think through which one applies. So for example, just by comparing this to the reference case of a test scalar field in FRW, the quantity which is which behaves as a free oscillator at early times, behaves as a Minkowski oscillator, at early times, is A times delta Infleton. But the quantity which is constant at late times, the thing whose late time power spectrum makes sense, is this. So this is just a change of variables in the Mukunov-Sasaki equation. So it's the z that appears in the equation of motion that matters, is z inverse psi, which is h over phi dot times delta phi. In the spatially flat gauge, you know, delta phi does slowly evolve after horizon crossing, but with this slowly time-dependent prefactor in front, it's constant. It's not too hard to show directly from the equations of motion. And let me introduce a temporary notation for this. I'll come back and call it something better later. But let's just call that n. So n can be interpreted in the following way. So here I have, and this is after horizon crossing, so everything's wavelength is much larger than the causal horizon, and I can just think of these fluctuations as being like shifts in a background. So delta phi just represents some shift in the field value of the Infleton relative to its time average. If I divide that by phi bar, then what I have is the amount of time that it takes for the Infleton fluctuation to go away, for it to catch up with the average. And if I multiply by h, I have the number of Hubbles, dimensionless number that it took. So this n is sort of like, you know, the number of Hubbles for, if I have a fluctuation in the inflaton, for the evolution of the universe to get rid of the fluctuation. Another way to think about it is that you're comparing two clocks. After horizon crossing, you can imagine that there are two clocks in the universe. There's the coordinate time t, and then there's the value of the inflaton fluctuation. This is just the difference between those two clocks expressed as a multiple of the local Hubble time. Okay, so that's after horizon crossing, but when is horizon crossing? Is it when k equals ah, or when k equals ZHZ. Well, strictly speaking, it ought to be this. It ought to be that it's the horizon crossing in the fake expansion history, since the time when the horizon crossing is really the time when the equations of motion transition between two asymptotic regimes. A regime where the canonically normalized psi behaves as a simple harmonic oscillator, and a regime where the quantity phi becomes constant. So strictly speaking, horizon crossing occurs when k is equal to zhz, which is defined to be the tau derivative. There's only one conformal time, but there's two expansion histories, so, you know, a physical one and a fake one. If I write this as the time derivative of log z, then and put in the definition of z here, then in the slow roll approximation, these time derivatives are slow roll suppressed. Phi dot and h don't change much in a Hubble time. So this is really the same thing as ah. The two notions of horizon crossing would only differ at subleading order in the slow roll expansion. Since horizon crossing is an approximate concept that really only makes sense in the slow roll limit, then we don't really differentiate between the two notions of horizon crossing. Z times hz is equal to ah, but of course the Hubbles are different. Since zhz is approximately equal to ah, the Hubble rate associated to the fake expansion history is this, which is h squared over phi dot. So there's a case for deciding when horizon crossing happened. The distinction isn't important, but here's a case where it is important. Okay, we're almost ready to read off the power spectrum of the inflaton. But since we want to talk about the late time power spectrum, we're going to compute the power spectrum of this quantity n. There's one more step, which is to get the normalization of the mode function. And so for that, we have to go back to the action. The spatially flat gauge, it's really easy to read off the normalization of the inflaton. We want the to just keep track of the piece of the quadratic action that contains two time derivatives of delta phi. And of course, the only place that's going to appear is here. So we just ignore, you know, this, for example. This calculation would be a lot more complicated in, say, a gauge where phi had been gauged into the metric, like the unitary gauge. Let's expand out the square root g as a cubed, and then put the time derivative of delta phi here. And then just converting to conformal time, each dt turns into an a d tau. Oh, this should have been dt. I also lost a 1/2. Okay. We see that the normalization of phi is what we had before. Phi prime equals I is the normal, is the correct normalization. And so that means if we compare to, you know, the two phis is confusing notation. If we compare to our reference case, then what I'm calling when we compare this normalization to the reference case, what I'm calling A delta phi, or what A delta phi is what I'm calling psi in the reference case. It's the canonically normalized field. So when we compare to the test scalar, the normalization would be psi prime equals I. And when we compare to the test scalar, take psi equal to A delta phi. So the normalization of psi is the same as in the reference case, which means that the normalization of n so n is defined relative to this with a by a factor of z. Its normalization would have look like this. Okay. And so the late time power spectrum, so the normalization is the same as the usual case, but normalization is the same as the reference case. Time power spectrum is, so there's not going to be any prefactor sitting in front here like the m Planck squared over 8 we had for the gravity waves, but there is a little subtlety because if we want to compare to the reference case, then the h squared that we have to use is the h of the fake expansion history, and as we showed, that's this is in the slow roll approximation. The Hubble rate of the fake expansion history is the real h squared over phi dot. One more final step is I'll go ahead, since I'm making the slow roll approximation in this step anyway, the exact mode function would be just given by integrating the Mukhanov-Sasaki equation for, say, A delta phi, or you could do it for n, with this normalization. But since I've made the slow roll approximation here anyway, I may as well substitute in this formula for phi dot. And write this as h squared over 4 epsilon m Planck squared k cubed. So this is the power spectrum of the quantity n. The only interpretation of which that we have at this point is that it's comparing two clocks, the inflaton and the coordinate, the inflaton field value and the coordinate time, in units of Hubble. Let's find out. What's 2 epsilon to the 1/2? All right, so I haven't really explained how to interpret n or how it's connected to the universe after inflation. No. I want to say a little bit about unitary gauge. I think the comparison is interesting. So this is a really fundamental result, and I'll say more about it later. So I'm just going to summarize. The calculation of the equations of motion is much easier in the unitary gauge. So the unitary gauge is defined by these gauge conditions. And the idea is that the idea of this gauge condition is that a metric of the form zeta times delta ij is supposed to satisfy the gauge condition. In unitary gauge, so you've gauged away the inflaton here and put it into the trace part of the metric. Let's denote by zeta, let's define that to be 1/3 the trace of the metric. So zeta will be the scalar degree of freedom that replaces the inflaton in spatially flat gauge. Now, I have the calculations here. I have some steps worked out. Unlike the spatially flat gauge, the calculation is relatively clean. If you solve, well, let me say a little bit about it. Here's one little side thing that I think is interesting. So after skipping a few steps, let me write down Einstein's equations. The steps that I'm skipping are just converting Einstein's equations to SVT form. These are just going to be scalar equations with longitudinal components of things, not equations with indices. So here's an intermediate step in the calculation where I've worked out the stress energy tensor for the inflaton in this gauge and substituted it in on the right-hand side of Einstein's equations. You get these three equations. So unlike in the spatially flat gauge, Einstein's equations were completely non-dynamical. They didn't have any time derivatives, and they just determined components of the metric, at least in the scalar, in the longitudinal sector, in terms of the inflaton fluctuation. But here there are time derivatives appearing. And these are dynamical equations that you can solve to get the equation of motion for zeta. But the question that I want to ask, which is sort of a conceptual one, is where did the potential V of phi go? Somehow, Einstein's equations are gauge invariant, and so the equations of these equations have to be equivalent to the equations of motion in the spatially flat gauge, where the potential appeared explicitly on the right-hand side, and it was clear that it was sort of a force derivatives of the potential were pushing field values around. That doesn't seem to be the case here, where the inflaton has been gauged away, and I just have some equations of motion for the components of the metric that don't even appear to involve the potential. So just sort of as a conceptual question, does anyone have an answer to this question? So the unitary gauge is very computationally convenient, but it's also very counterintuitive because of issues like this. It must be, I mean, V of phi must play a really crucial role because the power spectrum at the end has an epsilon in it, which is a derivative of the potential. So it turns out that it's hidden in there because the expansion history depends on it. Like, well, so for example, this phi dot squared, you know, it appears here in the equation of motion. And when I start manipulating these equations by like differentiating equations and plugging them in somewhere else, then more derivatives will appear. And so, you know, for example, after I take one derivative, I'll get this, and then the phi double dot, using the background equation of motion, has a v prime in it, and so the potential, sort of works its way into the equations. So the dependence on the potential is really hidden in the phi dot squared, and also in the h. I mean, the equation of motion for h depends on the potential. So it's there. It's just and it. Plays a really dominant role in determining things. It's just kind of hidden in this way of writing it. Okay, so I'm sort of skipping steps here because I kind of want to finish inflation today so we can talk about the late universe next week. And B, this would be, this just occurred to me that this would be a decent tutorial problem to just go through the calculation in the unitary gauge, where it's actually not very algebraically painful to get. So I claim, and you will see this in a few hours, that it is not very painful to get the equation of motion for zeta to sort of naturally work itself out in Mukunov-Sasaki form. Gee, this tutorial is a great device for like skipping steps. Okay. So in the, I'm sorry, I forgot an h dot here. This is sort of naturally what you get. And so this is the Mukunov-Sasaki form, with zeta being the quantity that's constant after horizon crossing. And a fake expansion history, which is given by z squared is equal to this. And then one last little step is that h dot is always Friedman's equations say this is always equal to 4 pi g times rho plus p. And then in inflation, this is just phi dot squared on the background solution. So you can see how the inflaton is working its way into equations that don't appear to have anything to do with it. So this turns out to, oh, sorry, I missed the square. And so this turns out to be, except for a 4 pi g, which I can just drop because I get the normalization from the action anyway, not the classical equations of motion. This turns out to be the same z that we had before. So the unitary gauge is very convenient. The calculation is much shorter for getting the equation of motion. The thing that's harder, actually, in unitary gauge is reading off the normalization of the mode functions. That turns out to be easier in the spatially flat gauge. Now, so we got the same equation for the same equation of motion in both gauges, but the quantity that appeared in the equation of motion was different. In the unitary gauge, it's zeta, which is the trace of the metric, sort of a volume expansion, one-third the trace of the metric. In the spatially flat gauge, it was this sort of unexpected parameter n, h over phi dot times delta phi. And of course, you can translate from one gauge to the other. That's consistent with how you translate from one gauge to the other. So if you imagine that you started out in unitary gauge, where the scalar degree of freedom was zeta, so you have some realization of zeta. And then you translate to the spatially flat gauge. Let's call that zeta unitary. In the last lecture, we worked out a formula for the gauge transformation that goes from an arbitrary gauge to the spatially flat gauge. And so in particular, we can go from the unitary gauge to the spatially flat gauge. This is also, I'm also going to sort of gloss over this. Maybe I'll put it in the tutorial. So using the formula for the gauge transformation that goes from unitary gauge to the spatially flat gauge, you'll find if you make that gauge transformation that the delta phi that you get in the spatially flat gauge is just minus phi dot over h times zeta. Or in other words, the quantity n that we sort of discovered empirically by putting the equations of motion in Mukunov-Sasaki form was just minus zeta in the unitary gauge. So if the same physics is described by an observer in each of these gauges, what the unitary observer calls zeta, the spatially flat gauge observer will call n. So generalizing this argument, you can translate zeta to any gauge. The result is the following. If I'm just in an arbitrary gauge, and then I change the gauge to the unitary gauge and read off the zeta, or go to spatially flat gauge and read off the n, then the value that I get is given by this. So in SVT notation, do this, or in a more standard index notation, it would be this. In an arbitrary gauge, if I take this weird-looking combination of fluctuations in the metric and in the inflaton, then that number is what I will get, what a unitary gauge observer would call zeta. And as a check, you can verify that this quantity is gauge invariant. That's really what I'm arguing here. If you apply an arbitrary gauge transformation alpha beta to this, it will be unchanged. And it has the value, in the unitary gauge where delta phi is 0 and h perpendicular is 0, that it's just 1/3 the trace of the metric. In the spatially flat gauge where these metric components are 0, it's just minus h over phi dot times delta phi. This is some sort of gauge invariant notion, which is sort of can always be interpreted as like comparing two clocks in units of the local Hubble parameter. So in the unitary gauge, the clocks that you're comparing are the coordinate time and the amount that the universe has expanded up to that point. That's what the trace of the space-based part of the metric is telling you. It's like just the local amount of spatial expansion. So that's really the bottom line for inflation in the scalar sector. There's a quantity zeta, a gauge invariant quantity, which goes to 0 after horizon crossing. And because it's gauge invariant, its equation of motion is the same in every gauge, and that equation of motion is the Mukunov-Sasaki equation. Where z is phi dot over h. My optimistic assumption that I'm going to finish talking about inflation today, I think, is not quite going to prove to be correct. And we know the power spectrum of this of zeta at the end of inflation. It's so it has the h squared over m Planck squared that we had for the gravity waves, but there's an epsilon downstairs. Okay. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the phenomenology, how we link these predictions to observations. I'm going to have to be a little hand-wavy because there's a one ingredient that I'm only going to show in detail later, or I'm only going to prove later. So it is a theorem. This goes by the name of Weinberg's theorem. Many Weinberg's theorems in physics. The Weinberg's theorem that is the default Weinberg's theorem if you're a cosmologist, is the statement that single field inflation implies adiabatic initial conditions during the hot Big Bang. What this means is that this quantity zeta, is conserved. Its derivative is zero all the way through the decay of the inflaton into a radiation-dominated universe. And after that decay, that the fluctuations in all the species in the plasma, the fluctuations in baryon density, photon density, and so on, are specified functions of zeta. We'll prove this theorem later and fill in all the details, like the coefficients that appear that relate the density fluctuation in various species to zeta. But for now, I just want to summarize the content of the theorem as saying that the zeta at the end of inflation, at least in single field inflation, determines the initial conditions of the universe in the hot Big Bang. And so zeta is something that you can just think about measuring. The power spectrum of the CMB that we measure is proportional to this P zeta. Roughly a picture that I like to keep in mind is that if this is time, and this is 1 over the length scale, 1 over AH, which is co-moving Hubble, then this is a decreasing function during inflation. During inflation, H is constant, so this goes as A to the minus 1. And then at some point, and so if I have a mode at some wave number, its wavelength k to the minus 1 becomes larger than the horizon. And as soon as that happens, the mode is frozen. And then at some point, the inflaton decays into radiation. This is called reheating. I'm not sure what the re is doing in this verb, but that's what it's called. And then we transition to a radiation-dominated, if here's inflation. Here's the radiation-dominated universe. Where H goes as A to the minus 2. And the co-moving Hubble length 1 over AH starts to increase. When the mode exits the horizon again, when it finds its wavelength shorter than the causal horizon, then it wakes up. So to speak. Zeta is no longer constant, and this mode can start oscillating and evolve into a CMB fluctuation. Now I want to talk a little bit about the observables that we measure. So both zeta, and a similar picture is true for the gravity waves. H perpendicular is also conserved when modes are superhorizon. So we can think of both zeta and H as things that we can measure in CMB. So I just want to orient you to the observer's way of thinking about this and some of the terminology that is used. So to start with, to take the gravity waves first, here was our formula for the power spectrum. The way this is usually parameterized is that we say the observables are an amplitude.
delta squared,
which is defined to be k cubed over 2 pi squared times power spectrum. Oh, just 2 over pi squared. Strictly speaking, this definition is slightly ambiguous when we say that delta squared, say, is no larger than 10 to the minus 10 from the CMB. That number depends slightly on which wave number we evaluate at, since the h star here is the slowly decreasing function of k. So usually some specific choice is made, just like what's become sort of a standard choice is 0.05 inverse megaparsecs. But it's not very dependent. The numerical value is not very dependent on this choice, since the dependence on k is slow roll suppressed. And then there's a tilt, which is defined to be just the derivative, the deviation from scale invariance. So let's calculate the tilt. Now, so far, gravity waves have not been observed. We just have upper limits. But if we do observe them, the next thing we'll look for is the tilt. Let's calculate this based on our formula. So to calculate the tilt, the reason that there is a tilt is because the h star depends on k. Let's say x star means evaluate x at horizon crossing. K equals AH. So if we're thinking of this as a function of K now, then what that means is that if we change K a little bit, we slightly change the, or log K, we slightly change the time at which we evaluate X. Since this is slow roll suppressed, I'll neglect it. And then let's write the d log a. I did a few steps here. Let's write it as h times dt. I'm just keeping track of the shift in the background value where I evaluate x, or h over phi dot times d phi. And then finally, using the slow roll formula for phi dot, this is 2 epsilon to the minus 1 half. M Planck to the minus 1 d phi, since phi dot is 2 epsilon. So for any quantity x evaluated at horizon crossing, there's an implicit k dependence. And the derivative with respect to log k is 2 epsilon to the 1 half m Planck times the derivative of x with respect to the inflaton field value. I have this on an unmoving blackboard. So in particular, we can calculate the tilt. We're just calculating the derivative of log h squared respect to log k. That's 2 epsilon to the 1 half m Planck derivative of log h squared. And then in the slow roll approximation, log squared is h squared is v up to a constant factor. All right, and that's never be a fight. So the definition of epsilon was M Planck squared over 2 times V prime over V. When I take the square root to plug in here, I've been using a convention throughout that phi dot is positive, so downhill goes from left to right, so that V prime is negative. So when I take the square root to plug in here, I should have minus 2 epsilon to the 1/2. And the final result that I get for the tilt is 2 epsilon. I haven't talked about scalars yet, but in the tensor sector, a measurement of gravity waves would correspond to a measurement of the energy scale of inflation. And if you were able to measure the tilt of those gravity waves or put bounds on it, then you would have a measurement of the flatness of the potential, V prime over V in Planck units. Okay. I have just a little bit more to say about inflation, but I'll have to stop for now. In the tutorial, I'll give you just some of the gaps that were skipped here in this derivation. I'll see you next week, when we'll talk a little bit more about inflation and then start talking about large-scale structure in the CMB.